Plant your exchange, 1,129 advancing, 294 declining. Volume on the big board is 16,080,000 shares. On the American, volume is 2,160,000 shares. There of 940 issues trading, 470 advancing and 206 declining. Among most widely held stocks, AT&T up 3/8. General Motors up 1 1/8. Exxon up 1 3/4. General Electric up 3/8. General Telephone and Electronics up 1/2. Among the most active stocks on the New York Exchange, Howard Johnson's up 1 3/8. Scott Paper up 3/8. And Teleprompter up 1/2. This is Brian McFadden reporting from New York.
Today's rise on the big board is credited to reports that Arab countries may shortly lift their oil boycott against the United States and that oil prices may decline as production increases. The price of gold and the U.S. dollar dropped today in London markets, but the British pound strengthened sharply with the end of uncertainty over the country's government. The same period of a declining dollar and soaring British pound was seen in the interbank foreign exchange market at Frankfurt. Len Bentling, responsible for today's news report. Len Bentling is your State Farm Insurance representative, located at 5th and Broadwater Avenue. The time is 12:15. The temperature unofficially is 50 degrees.
We welcome you to the Voice of Americanism, and we have a very special guest in the studio today. Mr. Botha, who is the South African consul in San Francisco. And we've asked him to come that we might question him very searchingly about some problems that many Americans are concerned about in relationship to a continent that is more and more in the news these days, the continent of Africa. We're interested in the viewpoint, both the official viewpoint and the personal viewpoint of a very fine man, Mr. Botha. We'll be back in just a moment to present our interview with him.
The Center for American Studies presents Dr. Stuart McBurney on the Voice of Americanism. This nationwide program stands for free enterprise and freedom under God. Now, Dr. McBurney and his analysis of the news.
Our guest in the studio today, Mr. Edward Botha from South Africa. He is the consul of his nation in San Francisco. And he's come to be with us on the broadcast today, and I'm going to ask him questions with no holds barred. We welcome him. We're glad to have him here. I think a great deal of South Africa, having been there on numerous occasions. But first, Mr. Botha, the question about the whole of Africa. Is there a way that you could characterize the fundamental struggle that is taking place throughout the entire continent?
Dr. McBurney, in the first instance, thank you very much for the opportunity. And secondly, then, a very difficult question put to me immediately. It's difficult to characterize the whole of Africa, except perhaps if you start off by saying that a non-African person, that would be somebody from America or Europe, very frequently thinks of Africa as black Africa, forget that Africa is basically divided into three areas. Egypt, which is not black Africa, Central Africa, which would then be black Africa, and Southern Africa, which is actually white Africa. Now, I have a white skin, but I am an African. And I'm an African by virtue of the fact that my family dates back to more than 300 years in South Africa. Now, that means that I am as African or more African than probably the average American is American.
Well, that's for sure, because whether you're an American or not doesn't really depend on how long you've been here, but whether or not you're a naturalized citizen. But we don't grant that same intellectual concept to people from Africa. All right, let's smash some more myths. You've described Africa as having three belts, the northern tier of nations, the Arab belt, the middle tier of nations, the black belt. That goes from the Congo on the west to what? How do you go through there?
Well, it will go all the way through to the Horn of Africa on the east.
Tanzania.
Tanzania, Kenya.
Then you drop down from there and you hit the Portuguese colonies. Or they're not really colonies anymore, are they? They're departments, aren't they?
Well, they refer to as departments.
Yes, and then there is, of course, Rhodesia. So you've got Rhodesia and the Portuguese Department of Angola on the north, and then you have South Africa and Southwest Africa, which is kind of mixed up these days, although I hope that you people can get it. Let's talk about that a minute. What about Southwest?
No. The South African point of view is, in fact, that the United Nations doesn't have any right over the early mandate.
The United Nations is not the legal successor to the League of Nations.
Correct,
right?
Yes.
Yes. Now, how can this be settled? Could a referendum be conducted in Southwest Africa?
Well, we have offered that the referendum should be held, and it could be done under international supervision. We are quite aware that it has to be done in a way, something like that. But it was not accepted by the United Nations, for instance, that they said it would
be... Well, how do they propose to solve the problem?
They evidently feel... Now, perhaps this relates to your initial question about the problems of Africa. I think if you want to boil it down to the real essence of it all, they want the Southwest Africa as a territory to become an independent territory and then to decide their future for themselves. The South African point of view, again, very briefly stated, is that we feel that it is a line that was drawn by previous powers. It includes autonomous nations. There are white people, there are various black nations there, and that each one of these groups really should have the right to their individual independence. And after they are independent countries, then to decide what they want to do as far as the future cooperation or whatever the case might be.
How many people live in Southwest Africa?
That I'm afraid is a statistic that I will have to look
roughly,
up.
Roughly, I mean.
Roughly, we are talking about, I should say, about 4 million.
Four million. And what percentage of that would be black?
Well, by far the larger percentage is black. The number of whites is a couple of hundred thousand, really, which live primarily just in Windhoek.
And most of the blacks, are they not, are bushmen in Southwest Africa?
No, we have the Ubambo and the Herero, and the blacks live actually in the more fertile northern regions of Southwest Africa. The whites live on the arid portion of Windhoek and down to the coast.
When I use the word bushman, I was thinking of it in terms of people who live in very rural areas rather than in cities.
Now, there are a number of bushmen still left, but then the number is small. The bushmen live in Southwest Africa and also in the Kalahari Desert. Incidentally, which is a very interesting thing, and that is that, as I said in the beginning, that people outside Africa view Africa and South Africa, for that matter, as black man's country. When white settlements came to South Africa, the only indigenous people found were Bushmen and Hottentot. The blacks were not really as nations present in the southern continent.
Well, what's a Hottentot? People have used that phrase perhaps more in other generations than now. I know what a Hottentot is, but for the sake of any in our audience who might not know technically, what are they?
Well, Hottentots were actually a group of Khoisan peoples. As opposed to Caucasian or Negroid.
They're not Negro.
No, they're not. These are yellow-skinned people, nomads, hunters and collectors of berry. Yellow-skinned, as I said, almost apricot color, really. And they were slightly bigger in stature than the Bushmen, but much smaller than either the Caucasian or the Negroid. And their numbers were tens of thousands in South Africa, and they moved in small family groups rather than as a nation or as a big tribe. They followed the southward migration of the Bushmen. The Bushmen actually came first south, then followed the Hottentots, and behind them followed the black nations, which now live in South Africa.
So when roughly did the Negroes come into South Africa? This is something totally unknown to most Americans. They suppose that the Negroes have been living in swarms there ever since the beginning of time.
Well, there were, of course, individual movements of single units or families into South Africa, as we know it today. There is sufficient anthropological evidence to show that they have been there for many hundreds of years. But the nations, larger nations as we know them now, moved into Southern Africa 600 or 500 years ago only. And they settled also when they moved, because they were herding cattle, really. They also settled in the more fertile regions of the Transvaal, the eastern Transvaal, and down along the east coast into Natal, and as far down as the Kai River on the east coast of the Cape.
But they did precede the white man.
They preceded the white man into certain areas in South Africa.
Well, only into certain areas?
In certain areas, yes.
Now, is this a point today in the whole argument about apartheid or division of race?
That is the most important point, is that in South Africa, neither the white nor the black nations. There are 9 black nations in South Africa. None of them claim the whole of South Africa due to prior occupation. Each one of us, there are these 10 major nations. So one white nation of about 4 million people, the Zulus of about 4, the Khoisans of about 3.9 million, and then the smaller Tswana, Sotho, etc. Now, all these 10 nations, they claim that a portion of South Africa was settled by that specific nation, and that the policy of apartheid of separate development is actually the acknowledgement of the fact that we have 10 nations in South Africa thrown together by previous colonial powers then.
Let me inject here that, ladies and gentlemen, in most countries in Africa, the big factor is tribalism. Tribalism is extremely socialistic. The tribe owns the land, the tribe earns the profits, and so forth. Now, I was in Rhodesia just a few months ago, and the big issue there is tribalism, the tribal trust lands, and so forth. But I gather that that is not quite the way it is in South Africa.
Well, what we have in South Africa is, in actual fact, that the 9 black nations live in areas which was settled by them, and therefore it is their legitimate land.
In other words, we distinguish between nations and tribes. And the tribal issue is not very big. It's the nation issue that's big?
It's the nation issue, yes.
Now, this, it seems to me, is something that most Americans do not know. Because I imagine the average person in America would say, well, tribe, nation, who cares? That's a term. But it isn't just a term. It's a reality, isn't it?
It's a reality so much so that if you look at the Zulu nation and the Sotho nation, which live in very close proximity, we are talking about 200 miles probably apart from each other, and you place the two next to each other, you immediately notice that the physical features differ. Their culture is different. When they speak, they don't understand
well,
the same language.
They want to integrate with each other.
No, they have given ample evidence not to do a thing like that. Let me quote Kaiser Matanzima, who is the paramount chief of the Khoisa nation, which is 12 tribes. He was in favor of a sort of a united front of all the black people in South Africa and forming one big black nation. He said that was a possibility, not that he was in favor of it. It was mentioned. The immediate reaction came from Lucas Mangope, the leader of the Tswana people, by 1.5 million. And his reaction was that you are about 4 million people, we are 1.5 million. If we had to integrate into one, we are going to disappear. Our culture is smaller and our nation is smaller, and we'll be sacrificed in the whole process, and I'm not prepared to do it.
Now, this is something the average American has not heard. And this is a complicating factor in this whole question of apartheid or apartness versus integration. And we have an American liberal who insists on liberation of all people to integrate in Africa. And your government's position is that integration is not too good a solution. And so I think, if I may, I'll ask you to stay on for our next broadcast and appear with me then. Let's discuss this whole thing in depth and very honestly. I think it would be very good, very wholesome. Ladies and gentlemen, your support of this program is why we are able to stay on the air. And I'd like to share back with you as a gift of appreciation a very useful tool. Unfortunately, 1974 has already become, it has amply proven, in fact, the correctness of our prediction made shortly after the first of the year that this would be the year of the terrorist. It's really true. Terrorism is rising. And it's going to reach you one of these days. And that's why we've written a brand new publication called 1974, The Year of the Terrorist. And you'll see in this information that you should have. I cannot bear down too strongly on this. Get this publication. Read it. Share it. It may mean a world of difference to your future. And the publication will be sent as a gift to those who help support this broadcast, the nonprofit work of The Voice of Americanism, Glendale, California, 91209. Goodbye, and be sure to tell your friends to listen to the next broadcast.
The Center for America...
the 6th of March, 74.